Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club's Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Santa Clara Convention Center. My name is John Lecrone. Today, I have the distinct pleasure of introducing Tom Brokaw, special correspondent for NBC News and best-selling author of The Time of Our Lives, A Conversation About America. A native of South Dakota, Tom joined NBC News in 1966 and has served as a White House correspondent, host of The Today Show, and spent 21 years as the anchor and managing editor of NBC Nightly News. He has traveled and reported from around the globe, bringing us coverage of historic events and exclusive interviews with leaders such as the Dalai Lama, Mikhail Gorbachev, and every U.S. president since Lyndon B. Johnson. Seeing the effects of combat firsthand from his numerous trips to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq, Tom has also made it his mission to recognize and honor the sacrifices that servicemen and women and military families make on a daily basis, citing that less than 1% of the U.S. population bears 100% of the burden of battle, he has brought a human aspect to our understanding of war and conflict. The best-selling author of 6 books, including The Greatest Generation and Boom, Tom has also produced 25 documentaries focused on issues ranging from race and war to immigration and global warming. For his unparalleled contributions and excellence in broadcast journalism, Tom is the recipient of 2 Peabody and DuPont Awards, a dozen Emmys, the Edward R. Murrow Lifetime Achievement Award, and the Walter Cronkite Award for Journalism Excellence. It is also my pleasure to introduce today's moderator, Dan Ashley, KGO TV news anchor and member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Tom Brokaw and Dan Ashley.
Good afternoon, everyone. Another hand for our wonderful speaker today, Mr. Tom Brokaw. Tom and I just met for the first time. What he doesn't realize, in my 25 years in broadcasting, he's been one of my mentors, and he didn't even know it. So I'm delighted to be here with you today. And one of the things that I will say is, I can tell you, first of all, that I think I can speak for Tom, and that in our industry, it's always nice to be in front of a large group of people who can't change the channel. So we'll both enjoy that. Let's begin. The book is The Time of Our Lives, and if you haven't picked up a copy, please do. It's a terrific read. I finished it this weekend. And let me ask you, Tom, to begin. What was the genesis of this book? Why did you write it, and why now?
Well, a combination of things, I think. First of all, I, much to my surprise, I turned 70. And then, having written about the greatest generation, I'm constantly thinking about the imprint of other generations on their time. And then we had the turn of the century. The 20th century was the American century. Shortly after we became 21st century, we were catapulted into the 2 longest wars in our nation's history, in Iraq and Afghanistan. We had 9/11. And there was a kind of disorientation in the country. Then in the spring of 2009, this was the moment that I really began to think about it seriously. I went to Dresden, Germany, which had been firebombed to within an inch of its life at the end of World War II, and then lived 40 years behind communist lines. Now it was a city struggling with its rebirth, but it was an integral part of the new unified country of Germany. And I met our new young president, Barack Obama, an African-American. I covered the civil rights movement in our wildest optimism. I don't think I expected to see an African-American president in my lifetime. And we stood there in Germany, which had been divided, which had been the axis of evil for much of the 30s and throughout the 40s. And he was going to Dachau with my friend Elie Wiesel to visit the camp. and we had been witness to the Holocaust. And then he was going to Normandy, where I had been the day before for the 65th anniversary of the greatest invasion in the history of mankind. Did nothing less than begin to save the world, really. And I walked away from that thinking this is not just another ordinary presidential interview that I've been doing. I've been doing them for a long time. I have been in the intersection of so much change in my personal and professional life. And we emerged from all of that, this country and this world, in a much different fashion than we went into it, and especially America. World War II in so many ways made the country. We were, at the end of the Depression, still on our backside, more or less, in terms of industrial might. We were largely an agricultural economy, trying to figure out how we fit into the world. And then after World War II, we were a colossus, and we built what we have today, and we're all the beneficiaries of that. And then you add on to it, I became a grandparent. And I was thinking about, what am I going to leave for my grandchildren? I know what my grandparents and my parents left for me. What do I leave for them? And that was the beginning of it. And it played right up against what we're all witness to and very frustrated by, which is the gridlock in our political culture, the polarization that has frozen America in place just at a time when we can't afford to have that happen. Because we're facing objectively a much, much different world than we were just 20 years ago. We have China, Brazil, India, Russia, emerging markets around the world. It's a smaller planet with many more people. So I've tried to kickstart a conversation about what do we do from here on out.
And I want to delve into all of the themes in your book, but let me dovetail on something you just mentioned, because there's a question from the audience regarding the Super Committee, which is apparently on the verge of announcing a failure today to solve some of the debt issues and trying to reduce the deficit something like $1.2 trillion over 10 years. And you refer to gridlock. This is the kind of frustration that I think many Americans feel, that this group in Washington charged with this task was able to come up with nothing.
About 3 years ago in Montana, one of my neighbors, a really smart guy, very conservative, came to me one day and he said, I'm just terrified about this national debt. And I said, well, the one encouraging thing is it's now on the agenda. And when we get things on the agenda, we find a way to work them out. I was wrong. I really didn't believe that we could become as polarized as we have been. That this committee, given what we know that we have to do in some fashion, was unable to find a way to even start the process. And based on all the reporting that I've been able to do and others have been able to do, they haven't even been talking to each other very much in the last 6 weeks. That's just unacceptable, it seems to me. Now, one of the examples that I use wherever I go, I actually use two. I was asked to come to the White House about 2 years ago. This is not unusual in every administration. I've done this as a reporter because I go across the country and I kind of have a feel for what's going on. I don't advise presidents, but I'm willing to report to them on what I see. I told this president the country was divided into two parts. One half is half-cocked in the ticked-off position, although I used another phrase besides ticked-off. And they are in a rage, and they don't believe in anything anymore. And that was before the Tea Party got started, but it was the roots of the Tea Party. So the other half of the country has given up on you, not just on you, but on Congress as well. A lot of them voted for you. And on Main Street America, they're just worrying about taking care of Main Street. The Republican banker is working with the Democrat who is a backhoe operator, the car dealer who may be the Republican is working with the Mexican-American worker at the food plant on the edge of town trying to make sure that they can buy a car. They're trying to hold what they've got together. And they've given up on our institutions of governance. I've never seen such a separation between Washington and the rest of the country. Congress is now in single digits in terms of people having confidence in it. It's an astonishing number. The other piece of it that I use is that we've asked less than 1% of our population to fight the two longest wars in our history. They're taking 100% of the bullets for the other 99% of us. What do we say to them about how we're behaving at home? They're mission-oriented. They come from all over America. They find a way to fight together and to solve problems and to win hearts and minds. They do that all day, every day, and they've been doing it for 10 years. Often in multiple tours. Now they're coming home, we hope, but to what turns out to be a broken economy and a broken political system. It's a terrible commentary on everyone. And then I end up, not in the White House, but in gatherings like this, saying, I think it's time for the rest of us to re-enlist the citizens. We're going to have to step forward here because they're not getting the job done. We're going to have to find a way to put pressure on them to get the job done.
And what does that mean, Tom? What sacrifice do you think, what contributions can people, should people be looking to make?
Well, I'm very attached to California. This is where I began my NBC career when I was very young. My wife and I had been married less than 3 years. We came out of South Dakota and suddenly we're in California. Our children were born here. One went to Berkeley, one went to Stanford. I used to say it was very similar to having one who was a member of the Grateful Dead, the other one who was a member of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
That's a good one.
Went over very well at Berkeley, not so hot at Stanford, I gotta tell you. But my point is, I've always cared about California a lot, and I have a daughter who lives in San Francisco, another one in Santa Monica. We're back and forth here a lot. California is on the leading edge of everything. And unfortunately, right now, it's on the leading edge of not being able to get things done. You get a $14 billion budget deficit in this state. And the cuts are going to be draconian when they come. And unfortunately, they're going to cut right into what has made this a great state. It's higher education system and the social services that have knitted this place together. I mean, you're sitting here in Silicon Valley, which is the great bubble in America, quite honestly. I've come out here to do two or three stories about Silicon Valley has made itself immune from these other pressures. But just outside of here, they exist. You've got communities going bankrupt in California, declaring bankruptcy. There's got to be a real urgency about it. And one of the things that I think needs to happen is if the special interest groups, which are so narrowly defined anymore because they're financed with big money, and then they can use blogs, bloggers, and the Internet to unleash what I call a jihad against candidates and their representatives. If you're a prison guard and you don't vote exactly the way I want you to, I have no use for you. If you're a member of the NRA, or if you're pro-choice, that becomes your litmus test. Nothing else counts. And therefore, we become less than the sum of our parts. So I have been suggesting there's a need for what I call the Coalition for Common Ground, or for Higher Ground, in which people who are frustrated by all this and may not see everything the same way, but know that there's a greater good here, have to get together. I'll just leave you with one thought. This surprises audiences. Whatever else you think about the Tea Party, they played by the rules. They got angry. They got organized. They got to Washington. They've stayed on message, and they've stayed disciplined. As a result, in the vacuum in which we now live, they have power way out of proportion to their numbers. Only about 12% of the public in all the polling say that they support what the Tea Party stands for. But they're driving the political dialogue on the Republican side right now. There needs to be a concurrent or concomitant movement from the middle to counter that. It is time for us to rise up and say enough in some fashion.
Tom, if I can back up Bettel for just a moment. When you're at the White House reporting what you have seen and heard around the country, and that so many Americans seem to have written the politicians off, what was the response? What was the reaction you got? Did they recognize it?
They took it in, but they didn't. I had the same conversation with Speaker Boehner and with Mitch McConnell about the same week. I was up on the Hill doing something, and the Speaker came over to me and said, I know you've been out there, what are you hearing? So I told him the same thing. And there's this kind of nodding and a resistance to it. In part, right now, we're trapped by the election cycle. Everything that you're seeing right now is all about 2012. That's what's driving everything. The Republicans are terrified of, in any way, raising some additional revenue because they think it'll run cross currents to their base. Democrats are trapped in keeping entitlements where they are. They can't tinker with them even, because they worry that that will hurt their base. And as a result, they're frozen in place. If you get just beyond the beltway, whether you have really conservative Republican businessmen or really liberal Democrats in one fashion or another, they all say we've got to do something about this. But inside the beltway, they're stuck in place at the moment. And we're going to pay a price for that because it's going to come in draconian fashion downstream. I had a conversation with the AARP the other day because I was on Meet the Press recently. We ran a little piece of their now canceled commercial that they were doing. You probably have all seen it, kind of a attractive husky guy of a certain age says, "Who am I? I'm a member of the AARP. Who are we? We're 50 million strong." And then they gather around behind him, and he looks in the camera, and he says in a threatening fashion, "If you cut our Medicare and Social Security benefits, remember, we vote." And I said, that's exactly the wrong message that we ought to be sending now. And so they called me, and because I've done a fair amount of business with them, and they said, "Well, we were, Tom, you know," I said, "if you had said, no one knows more about entitlement programs than the AARP because so many of our members depend on them. But we also know that change is coming, and we want to be a part of that discussion because we have some ideas, and we'd like Washington to invite us into it and all the other groups as well." I said, I would have stood up and cheered, but everybody's got the finger in your face, and that's how you don't get things done. So you have to create a different kind of coalition.
Thomas, you talk about in the book, and as we know from experience, it didn't used to be this way, this demonization of the other side. Not only do I disagree, but you're evil for feeling the way that you do. There's always a constellation of factors for something like this, but how, in your estimation, how did we evolve to this point? Was there a trigger point, or did it just sort of...
I don't think it's a trigger point. I think the new technology has a lot to do with it. I think that you can unleash, as I described it earlier, a jihad through blogging. Every senator, every congressman, every public servant now has somebody just monitoring what is being said about them. And so they live in an exaggerated state of terror as a result of it. And, you know, it only takes a couple of keystrokes to mount that kind of a campaign. It doesn't have to be credible even. You just get it going and you can't get it reeled back in. The other thing is money is bigger than ever. And as a result, all these individual special interests across the political spectrum have a lot of money. And money is the mother's milk of politics. That's the famous phrase of the late Jess Undrew, who some of you will remember was the leader of the California Assembly, a Democrat. But going back to that time, when Ronald Reagan got elected in 1966, that was the first big assignment I had in California. He was going up against a very smart, very liberal California Democratic Assembly led by Jess Undrew, Willie Brown, Bob Moretti, all those young Turks. And after about 3 months, Jess Undrew came to me and said kind of wide-eyed, "We can do business with this guy. You know, we can go in there, close the door, and get things done. He listens to us, and we have to listen to him. We know that he won, and we're going to find a way to do that." And for the next 8 years, they did. It wasn't perfect, but by and large, they were able to move this state along the lines that it needed to be moved along. Now it's best summed up by an anecdote I have in the book. About 4 years ago, I was in Washington, and two really button-bright young men came up to me. You would recognize the types. They had blue suits, red ties, and white shirts, and they were just eager beavers on Capitol Hill. And they said, "Mr. Brokaw, we want to talk to you about the old days." And I think that they met in 1998. I'm not sure. And I said, "What do you want to know?" And the one of them said to me, "I'm a Republican. He's a Democrat. He's my best friend. We go to Georgetown every night, drink beer, and argue politics until late. We both work for congressmen. His boss won't talk to my boss. My boss won't talk to his boss. Was it always like that?" And I said, "No, quite the contrary. You know, during the constitutional crisis of Watergate, at the end of the day when the sun went down, across the aisle, Democrats and Republicans would say, if this doesn't work out, how do we plan for the transition? What are the issues that we need to be thinking about impeachment, how we get that done?" And any number of other times in our lives, we've been through that. To go back to Ronald Reagan, when he got to the White House, the conservatives were not very happy because he opened a direct line to Speaker O'Neill on the Hill. My friend Jim Baker was his White House chief of staff, and one of Tip's staff members, actually, was Chris Matthews, who was his press secretary at the time. He said, about twice a week, he said, I'd look in the back anteroom, and there would be Jim Baker, who slipped up from the White House, and he wanted to give the speaker a heads up on what they were planning for the next week in case there were any issues so they could work them out. That's how it's always worked, at whatever level. We've lost that now. And I have a phrase in the book, it grows out of the West. if you're a cattle rancher, when you get a new calf, you ear tag the calf. You just put an ear tag on with a number so you know how to identify that calf. And so all these herds across the Great West and the Midwest have ear tags on them. We now ear tag everybody in America. They get ear tagged as a conservative or they get ear tagged as a liberal, and they are stuck in that position which has been imposed on them from the outside. And as a result, if you watch Fox News and you have a liberal on, there's a sneer. If you watch MSNBC and they have a conservative on, there's a sneer. And that's fine, but we've got to have a broader playing field than that so that we can have real discussion about people who are moderates. The greatest gains I've ever seen in American life have come from people who were able to stay within their ideology but always understand they didn't have all the answers. My definition of patriotism, which I use in this book, is always love your country and always believe it can be improved. You know, that has to be the kind of leitmotif about how we move forward.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Dan Ashley from ABC 7 in San Francisco, and our distinguished guest today is Mr. Tom Brokaw of NBC News. His book, The Time of Our Lives, A Conversation About America. Talking about moving the country forward, you focus a lot in the book about education and your grave concerns about where the state of public education is in the United States. Although, interestingly, you point out that our college system, graduates who come through college, are actually quite well prepared for the job market, but getting there is a challenge. Talk a little bit about your concerns and your
observations. Well, I really believe that education is the currency of the 21st century. I mean, that's going to help define who we are, and it's really a matter of national security. We have to educate everybody because we're competing in a different environment now. In the past, actually, I talked to Jeff Immelt, who runs GE, about this. And we were looking at the Reagan recession. When he first took office to try to get inflation under control, they cracked down. We had a high unemployment. It went on for quite a while, 2 years into his administration. When they came out of it, then they had kind of a clear playing field ahead of them. Now, we've got China, the number two economy in the world, and it's come from nowhere to get to be number two. We've got India, which is on a tear, to say nothing of Brazil, Russia, as well, the BRIC nations are called. And then you've got Korea. We've got a rising kind of economic base going on in South America. Same thing is happening in all the old Soviet satellite states. The countries that are in trouble are the traditionally strong countries of Western Europe, for example, and the United States. So those are the objective realities that we're dealing with, and the way you're going to solve that is have a better educated populace, encouraging entrepreneurship and innovation and an ability to work anywhere in the world, but especially here at home. Modern manufacturers say that they can't get a good workforce out of the American system because young people coming out are challenged, frankly, in terms of math and reading skills. I think it's 20% of our high school graduates going to college now have to have remedial courses in literacy and in math. We have a big boom going on in community colleges, which is a good thing because they can teach job skills for the modern manufacturing place, and they're also good bargains. But we really have to fix education across the board, and that means from the bottom up. For too long, we left the lower socioeconomic classes to their own devices. You know, those of us would move to the suburbs or send our kids to private schools and leave everybody else behind. That no longer is acceptable. What is encouraging is that this issue now is on the agenda and that people are paying attention and they're trying a variety of ways of addressing it. Charter schools, taking on the teachers' unions, trying to find the common ground. Mayors becoming responsible for their school system so you know who to hold accountable for it at election time if it doesn't work. More and more public-private partnerships going in, which private corporations are moving into cities and getting involved in the school system because they, A, need workers, and B, they need educated consumers who can make enough money to afford their goods.
Tom, on this point from the audience, what are your views on the increasing income disparity between the middle class and the rich? That's from a member from the audience, and I'll dovetail into that some other questions that I've received about the Occupy movement that's going on currently.
Well, it's a big issue. And what it is a slow-burning fuse at the moment, because you can't have a society that is has such gaps. You know, David Brooks has written about this, and I think it was, he said 25 years ago, there was very little difference between those who were in the upper middle class and the middle class in terms of divorce and objectives and dreams that they have in their lives. That's all changed enormously. And I saw some numbers today in which the top 1% of the population between 79 and 97 gained 225% income growth, while the middle class gained 40%. And people are aware of that. And there's a lot of discussion about we don't want to have class warfare. Well, we've got class warfare because we've got a class that's making a lot of money. And I happen to be one of them. I've, you know, kind of won what I call the lottery of American life. I'm utterly conscious of that. And I also have a brother who retired as a crew chief on the telephone company. He's living in a different place than I am. And we talk about this a lot in our family. Then I have a daughter who's a doctor in San Francisco, married to a doctor in San Francisco, and as she said today, we did an earlier session together, she said, I'm the first generation that is moving down, not up, because of the cost of housing and the cost of education and all the other things, which is true. So there are a lot of tectonic plates that are in play here, and what we don't want them to do is to reach a critical mass in which we have real class warfare. Occupy Wall Street. It's... In my judgment, I've looked at Chicago, I was just in San Francisco, been in New York, obviously, and looked at it. It's absence of theme at the moment. What is it that you want here? And a lot of people have kind of gravitated to the tent cities because, frankly, a lot of them are just adrift in our society. And I would have thought that they would have strengthened the leadership earlier and sharpened up the message about what they wanted and how they wanted to achieve it. That hasn't happened yet, so I don't know quite where it goes. I have said to my friends on Wall Street that, and we had this conversation this morning in San Francisco, there are a lot of good people on Wall Street. One of them just died over the weekend, Ted Forstman, who was the head of Forstman Little. He was an extraordinarily inventive guy in venture capital, helped invent LBOs. He always ran it responsibly. Huge philanthropist, gave away hundreds of millions of dollars. Help bring education to the fore, frankly, about with charter schools and vouchers and other things. So a lot of good people, and we need Wall Street. We need a financial services industry that can help, you know, finance bonds for communities or provide capital for entrepreneurs to come on online. But I think that this responsible, credible senior statesman of Wall Street should start now.
You mentioned David Brooks. He said that the United States will be Greece in 10 years, Tom. Do you agree with that?
I don't think we'll get as far as Greece. But it's also striking. Greece is a perfect example of the conditions that we're living. Greece got the flu and we were in danger of getting pneumonia. That had never happened to us before. And that's what we're thinking because there's so much connectivity in the world now and it all happens at warp speed. Here's a little country that most people don't pay their taxes in and they don't really produce anything and they got in big credit trouble because they were along for the ride as well. And then bang, we found out that a lot of our financial institutions were invested in their bonds and a lot of their instruments of debt and we were in danger. And that will continue. Just today in the Financial Times, the Chinese are saying they're very, very worried about another global recession. And I've been talking in the last week or so with economist in New York as part of a series at the Lincoln Center, and we're not out of this yet. You know, we've got work to do. But there's no sense of alacrity or urgency in Washington about it. You know, I think in California and other states, by the way, you know, in Southern California, you don't have this in the North. They have the Santa Ana winds. You know what the Santa Ana winds that come out of the desert. I think we need Santa Ana winds blowing across the state of California that have an odor to them, and they're very high. And they're a reminder of what the budget deficit is here. It's $14 billion. And that is going to have enormous consequences, short and long term, on this state. For the next generation, for the cost of education, for the services that will be eliminated or cut down. Because just as we got in trouble, not managing well, the expansion of both public and private debt, we can get in equal trouble in not managing well the reduction of the services and the skillful way that we manage our way out of this. And at the moment, it's what I call the equivalent of fragging, which was that horrendous practice in Vietnam in which a grenade pin was pulled and rolled into a tent. That's what we're doing now. We're not bringing our best judgment to some of the decisions that are being made about what priorities are.
And you mentioned there's no sense of urgency in Washington. I think what a lot of Americans would wonder and ask is, how can that be, given what's happening? How can they be so divorced or disconnected from what we're feeling?
Well, a lot of them are captive to ideology, and they're all worried about re-election. And because of, this gets really wonkish, but you'll have to stay with me for a moment, but because of redistricting in the country, people come from safe districts. And the safe districts are drawn around common interests. And so they serve just those common interests that may not reflect the broader concerns of a community or a valley or a section of the country that they happen to represent. And by the way, that's across the board. It's not just Republicans. It's Democrats and independents as well. There will be a third party attempt this year online called Elect USA. You'll be hearing and reading more about it. Can they come up with a candidate? Can they change the DNA? The people who are organizing are smart. They've got a lot of money. I remain a skeptic at this point.
Okay. A couple of things that you talk about in the book, Tom, The Time of Our Lives, the technology gap and how technology has changed our world for good and for bad. Talk a little bit about the changes you've witnessed and the effect that it has had, and also maybe if you can roll into that the generation gap, because you make an interesting comment in your book that in some ways technology has helped generations move closer together in some respects.
Well, it cuts both ways, it seems to me. I got very interested in this very quickly because I knew it would affect our business. And I also, I remember this the first time we got the new Mac and put it in our kitchen. And we lived in an apartment in New York, and I went down that night. I woke up in the middle of the night, went down, and there was a kid from living three floors down who was working on our Mac. Turns out it was Jerry Brown's nephew, by the way. And he was there. And for the next 3 weeks, up and down the staircase, kids were coming from all over to get on our Mac. And coincidentally, I was having lunch. He came to have an editorial board meeting at NBC with the new CEO of IBM. John Akers was his name. And I said to him, "What do you think of the Mac?" "Not going to go anywhere." Yeah, well, he didn't last long in that job. My feeling about the new technology is it's complex. It is so powerful that we haven't yet caught up to the extraordinary reach of it, I don't think. It's creating what I call the second Big Bang. We have a new universe out there. We're trying to figure out which planets will drift too close to the sun and burn up, which ones will support life, which ones will not. We have not had a national dialogue about the use of it, especially down through the generations. I say to college audiences very often, I envy you that your life will have these tools for commerce and for research and for communication and for untold other reasons. But let me remind you of something. You're not going to eliminate global poverty by hitting delete. You won't change climate change by hitting backspace. No text message in the world will ever replace the whispered "I love you" or the first kiss. And I don't ever want to hear a song that has as a lyric, "A tweet is just a tweet as time goes by."
Loses a little of the romance, doesn't it?
Right. Well, and one of the examples I use, my generation should have conversation with your grandchildren about online bullying, for example, which is a real issue in this country, about what goes on, about how somebody can get singled out and be mocked. And we've had cases of suicide and people in severe depression. One of the ways I suggest that we talk about it, my generation, we should talk about what happened with racism when we were young or when we watched that change America. We're a much better society for that. And then I'm able to swing into the fact that Dr. King changed this country profoundly, liberated us all from the shackles of segregation, somehow managed to do it without a cell phone, without a website, without tweeting. He did it through the power of his beliefs and his oratory and the rule of law. And he did it in a nonviolent fashion. So that's the kind of conversation that I'd like to see going on across generational lines.
You know, in your other book, The Greatest Generation, which was so fantastic, you know, you've seen so many changes and chronicled so many changes in our society, just in its makeup, and I'm not talking about race or gender, just its tone and its feel. And it seems to me that I have two kids in college now, and, you know, I work at night at the television station. I was as guilty as anyone else. I wish we had more family dinners, you know. And I think many of us now, with two parents working or maybe only one parent in the house, we are disconnected from young people in a way that we were not years ago. And I think your comments on how that has fundamentally changed sort of the tone and texture of our family.
Well, I'm not saying let's, you know, roll the clock back to 1958 when we were able to do that. But I do think that we should be thinking about it. Oddly enough, and one of the consequences of this economic downturn, I've talked to a lot of families who have really been hit hard. They've lost jobs, they've lost their homes. Their lives have changed dramatically because of unemployment or foreclosure, or Nevada especially is an example of that, where they, you know, jobs dried up. And they're very brave. They're working their way through it. They're, you know, cutting up credit cards and they're reducing their living standard. They've walked away from their homes. They're renting. They almost all say to me, but we're closer as a family because we have to be. We're spending nights at home instead of at Applebee's or going to a movie. And we're running films for a dollar a night from Redbox or wherever you happen to get them. And they're thinking about, you know, their children are thinking about, I'm not going to buy a house I can't afford. You know, I'm going to buy something smaller. I'm going to rent. I think that there's a paradigm shift that is underway, and we have to think about that. I fly in helicopters over a lot of America. I've been doing this a long time. I'm still slack-jawed when I fly over Southern California or parts of Florida or parts of the Southwest to see the rows of McMansions with three bay garages and, you know, and big rooms and everything. And I know that both parents are working, just trying to keep up with it all. And there's a turn. Square footage in housing is starting down. Builders are now eliminating some fireplaces, and they're building one bay fewer on their garages. They're not building the full basements anymore because we kind of lost control for a while. That will have an impact on succeeding generations.
This is from the audience, Tom. What changes could be made so that government represents the American people rather than money and special interests? Are there any sort of systemic or institutional changes that you can envision?
Well, I think let's start in California. One of the things that you're still trapped in California is a referendum system. That has to be changed. That has to be reformed because willful, well-financed, narrow groups can really drive California politics way out of proportion to their numbers, and everything comes back to the referendum. Therefore, you lose courage in Sacramento because they said, well, we'll send it to a referendum. We won't make a decision here. That's a big, big issue for me. And then to go back to what I said earlier, and I'm not being Pollyannish about this, you have to get organized. You have to decide, you know, how do you want to pull this together and pick a cause. Here are a couple of examples. People say, well, God, it's just so big. And this came to me in the course of writing this book. I thought, so what have I seen in America after Dr. King that really changed the country, that everybody could identify with? Candace Leitner was a mother who lost a daughter to a drunk driver. She started Mothers Against Drunk Driving, called MAD. We're all familiar with it now. It profoundly changed the laws in this country. And it changed social behavior about drinking and driving. I mean, dramatically. And saved thousands of lives. I've gotten to know Nancy Brinker some. Nancy Brinker had a sister who was dying of breast cancer, and she said to her sister, I will do everything I can to try to find a cure, and started with a shoebox full of names and not very much money, and it's Komen Race for the Cure. You go to a football game in the fall now, and you see these big, tough linebackers coming out with pink shoelaces to remind everybody that we're in search of a cure for breast cancer. That's had a huge impact on this country. Because two determined women got organized around that and then found like-minded people.
All right. I want to spend a few minutes talking about the media universe and the changes that you've seen for good and for bad. And there's a question that I'll get to from the audience. But let me begin. Even in the 25 years I've been in this industry, it's completely different. In the probably 45 years you've been in, or 50 at this point, that you've been in the industry, you've seen it change night and day. Talk a little bit about how different journalism is today, electronic journalism particularly, but all of it, and, well, and what effect that's had on the country.
I go back to Stone Age, and part of the reason I'm sitting here tonight is that I, at the age of 20, I was a political junkie early on. I was working in radio stations after basketball and football practice when I was a kid. I was writing for the school newspapers, but I didn't quite know how that was going to get me on the South Dakota horizons. And on election night in 1960, I stayed up all night long till 8 o'clock in the morning, Kennedy versus Nixon. And I watched NBC, Chet Huntley and David Brinkley, and I saw John Chancellor and Frank McGee and all these people that I later had the privilege of working with. That's what I want to do. And it was a meritocracy. They were out there trying to find people all over the country to join this exciting new venture. You didn't have to have a pedigree from Yale or someplace else. If you could do it, you could do it. And it was a duopoly. CBS and NBC only.
Right.
I love that. We didn't have to worry about competition. We could just kind of go do what we wanted to do. Think about the sweeping change since then. The screen is so crowded with all these different places that you can go to retrieve information. This will surprise you. I think it's a good thing. We have the richest menu of choices we've ever had in our lifetime at a keystroke. And get up in the morning. A friend of mine is the editor of the Financial Times. I go on and see what Lionel's done with his paper that day. I can check my hometown newspaper in South Dakota to find out how the old high school football team is doing. I can go to the Council of Foreign Relations, where I'm a board member, because we have the best website when it comes to foreign developments overnight and also long-term think papers. I'm getting ready to go to Saudi Arabia again, probably sometime after the first of the year, to I hope to interview the new crown prince, who will be the successor to the king who's died. And I am now reading everything I can from the Saudi websites, including from their foreign ministry, about what their policies are. We've never had that chance before. Here's the difference. We can't be couch potatoes anymore. We just can't get up in the morning and take paper off the front porch and watch a little bit of the Today Show and catch the evening news and catch the late news with Dana and then be happy with what we've got. Choices are much more complicated than that now, and we have to apply filters to what we're seeing, especially off the Internet. Where'd it come from? What's the motive here? Does it hold up over time? One of the lines that I've been using in audiences is that we have to put as much effort in determining the reliability and the integrity and the longevity of the information that you get to buying a flat-screen television set or, you know, even a new pair of shoes. You know, you make some judgments. I have a friend in Montana, a woman who is really apolitical, lives way out in the middle of nowhere, frankly, and comes to me about once a week wide-eyed and says, "You're not going to believe what I read on the Internet today." And my answer is always the same. I say, "You're right, I'm not going to believe it, actually." So we have to develop our own filtration systems. And if you do that, then you have a lot more choices. Look, I know about people yelling on cable television and the food fights that go on. I've got something at home that maybe the rest of you ought to think about getting. It's called a remote control. I don't watch it if I don't like it or if it seems to be going nowhere. But I love the range of choices that I have.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things I've noticed you have too, I'm sure, Tom, is with everyone much more informed and better able to access information, the mistake isn't even out of my mouth.
No.
And the email is on its way. Dan, you stupid idiot, don't you know? It really makes us accountable and keeps us on our toes in a way that we hadn't had to be before.
On the other hand, my wife and I were in a fairly serious car wreck in New York, and we were very, very lucky. Nothing happened to us, but a young woman was killed, and it was a big crack up on the Bruckner Expressway. The mail truck up over the median, our car slid beneath it, and another car rolled, and then it's a very busy expressway, so there are a lot of people taking cell phone pictures right away. Mm-hmm. And Meredith said to me quickly, she said, "You better call the office and get your statement out right now." I had just given the police, the investigators, our version of what had happened, so I did that. And I said, "Hang on to it, don't release it. You're probably going to start getting some calls." And about an hour later, the calls started coming in. That was at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. By 6 o'clock that night when we got home, I was hearing from friends all over the world. "Are you okay? Are you sure you're not hurt?" They saw the pictures. That was from Moscow and Beijing and all kinds of places. And then my wife's a very, very active user of all the information technology, but doesn't go to the blogs in the same way that I do because I'm trying to keep track of what's happening. And the next day I went up and I wrote in our names. to show her what was going on. And all these websites, it can be for animal husbandry. You know, it can be a website dedicated to 19th century lingerie collectors. But they all need content. So they take the fact of the accident, they put it on their website, whether it's related to anything that they do or not, and then they say, comments invited. And then there's this whole string of comments that follow. And as one of my friends says, these are guys sitting in their underwear in their basement who are going to get back at you because you're on television and you've had a pretty good life. And so they just write whatever comes to their mind. And what they wrote some scurrilous things about our personal relationship that had no basis in fact. One guy wrote that he had a friend who was in a traffic jam, broke out, was dead drunk, paying off the cops. You don't get to reel that back in.
Yeah,
that's out there and it stays there. And so you just have to hope that people will have some judgment about it. That's the real downside.
And that speaks to something you talk about in the book and you've mentioned here. You know, as an adult, hey, and as a public figure, you can take the hit. But when you're a teenager and this kind of thing is being raced around the Internet, it's very painful. And
very
it's
painful.
Unable, you can't process it.
That's right. And that's the conversation that we should have. I write in the book about a situation in New Canaan, Connecticut, a very prosperous town. Kind of a classic upscale town in Connecticut, some of you may be familiar with. And when President Obama wanted to talk to the schools, you remember that, when he wanted to talk to schools in the first few months he was in office, the Republican committee in that town went to the school board and said, we don't want him talking to the schools in an unfiltered fashion. And he made it clear he was just going to talk about the value of studying and being helpful to one another. And so the school, in a kind of rushed way, set up this very complex system about who got to watch the president talk to him, and they would tape it, and then the teachers would play it back for them if they had permission from their parents to see the playback, and it went on and on and on. So I was on Meet the Press that morning, on a Sunday morning after this was all happening, with Rudy Giuliani and Harold Ford, the former congressman from Tennessee, and Tom Friedman, my friend from the New York Times. I was the only one who was conscious of this because I had a friend in New Canaan that alerted me to it, and I introduced it to the table and said, I just think this is what's wrong, that we've lost control about not having a president talk. Ronald Reagan talked to students, almost every president has. Mayor Giuliani said, you know, as mayor, I talk to classes a lot. I got an aggrieved call the next day from the school superintendent in New Canaan, and he said, I'm sure you think it's not appropriate for third and fourth graders. And I said, I've got granddaughters. They'd be thrilled to hear the president. I don't care whether he's a Republican or a Democrat, I mean, or a woman. They'd be thrilled to hear the president talk to him about the importance of studying. And we were getting nowhere in this complex system. I finally said, let me cut to the chase here. Let me ask you a question. Knowing New Canaan, I said, I suspect that most of your high school students come to school with a laptop. He said, oh, yeah, they almost all do. I said, you're wireless? And he said, oh, yeah. And I said, so they spend the whole day online. Do you monitor that? Do you know where they're going? You know what they're reading in your classroom? Long pause. No. I said, I rest my case. You won't allow them to hear the president, but they have an unfiltered entree to anything that's going on in the world. And these are the discussions that we should be having, frankly, in our communities and in our families and so on. When the whole online thing first started, any number of parents came to me and said, I know, Tom, you know a lot about this. You're not going to believe little Billy. He's just a whiz. And I said, you know where he's going? Well, what do you mean? I said, do you know what he's accessing? No, the next time I would see him, they'd say, well, we approach the room, we hear clack, 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 quickly, and he's closing up sights. And I said, that's the point.
Yeah.
So you've got to have the conversation.
Tom, a week or two ago, you were on Jon Stewart, which was a great appearance, talking about the book and other issues. And someone in the audience asked a question about Comedy Central's Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and what role they play in adding to the conversation or detracting from the conversation. Talk a little bit about, you made an appearance on that program. Talk a little bit about its impact and why it's so pervasive now.
But before John began the program, he came to see me, and I didn't know him very well. I knew him as a very hip stand-up comic. And this was some time ago now. I can't remember. We were maybe in San Diego for the convention, which Bob Dole was nominated. It was some time ago. And I said, we're missing political satire in this country. It's an important component of political discussion. I had no idea that he was going to do it as well as he does it. I mean, I really think it's a brilliant program, and in part because of John's keen interest and a very good mind, and also the staff that collects stuff. And they put it in context. The night that I was on, for example, it was when Herman Cain had really first gotten in trouble about sexual harassment settlements and agreements, or however he wanted to characterize them. And John, in a surgical way, just walked you through the inconsistencies in his statements. And then some of the McCain, or the Cain supporters, and what they were saying, Ann Coulter going so far as to say, well, the reason there's such a fuss about this is, speaking for the Republicans and conservatives, she says, our blacks are better than their blacks. I mean, it was like a plantation statement of some kind that she was making. And John just walked you through it and made that available to his young audience. And it was before I came on, and I thought to myself, this is a real service to the audience, because they can see now how this developed and evolved, and they're getting, without a lot of John commentary in this case, the true facts. I think it's helpful because it does bring young people into the arena in terms of politics. And the other thing about it is I'm partial, because they're two terrific guys, Stephen and John, and they're not wildly partisan one way or the other. They really worry a lot about their children. I have more conversations about raising kids with them than I do about politics, quite honestly. And there's just an essential decency about them. And all the success has not gone to their head. I have a real radar screen for that stuff, about what happens to people when they suddenly pop up, you know, on the television screen. How do they handle it? And not a lot do very well, but John and Stephen especially have handled it with grace and with modesty, and they know where they are, and they know what to do, and they know how not to play outside their lines, so to speak. They're two very generous guys. So I think it's good, because it causes people to think more and talk more about politics, and especially young people.
Okay. Talk a few more issues. You mentioned you're going to Saudi Arabia soon, maybe by the end of the year. From the audience, how will you solve, or will we solve, the Middle East crisis? What do you see happening there after the Arab Spring the changes? What's going to happen?
I was there right after Arab Spring. It was still actually percolating, and I was in Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Iraq, and I was talking to a lot of my friends in that region. And no one knows how this is going to turn out. They just know it's going to be different. It's a real sea change. My wife has just returned from Abu Dhabi and Dubai and from Jordan as well. And she had not gone deep into the Middle East before. And she came back and she said, now I get what you've always talked about. It's so complex, because you've got the tribal loyalty that plays very, very deep in all those countries, and the great stakes that are there as well. Then you have the overlay of the traditional Muslims and the radical Muslims in play. And then finally, and this is the most important piece of it all for the rest of us, we have as our principal ally there Israel, with good reason. And then we have this kind of ransom deal, as I describe it, with the oil producers, that we're so tied into them because that's where we're getting all of our energy, is in that part of the world. And we can't bring much pressure to bear on them because they own the oil and we need it. And we're not thinking enough about how we can change that equation. I was very senior members of the Saudi royal family right after we had put pressure on Mubarak to resign from Egypt. And they were furious because they saw that if we did that to Mubarak, who had been our friend, what would we do to them? And they said, in effect, the Saudi royal foreign minister said to me, we know best how to handle this in the Middle East. We don't need you to come in here and tell us how to do it. So this is a really, really tricky piece for the foreseeable future. And it's very, very hard to have any kind of a crystal ball to know how it's going to turn out. You know, you're witness to what's going on in Egypt right now. The Egyptian military has always been the strongest force in that country. Mubarak came from it. And they're not, I don't think, about, without a fair amount of fighting, to turn it over to a civilian government over which they have no control. So that's Egypt. That's the biggest, most important piece of it. And then all around the edges of it, you know, you've still got Syria fighting with everybody else. We don't know how Libya is going to turn out now that Gaddafi is gone. So there's a lot at stake here.
Tom, what... from the audience, you can speak to this as a native of South Dakota. What do you think could be done to help the Native Americans in this country who still struggle in so many parts of the country?
You know, I grew up with Native Americans in South Dakota, and I had one of those bifurcated childhoods. I was very close to him when I was a teenager because I lived on the edge of a reservation, and a lot of them lived way out in the country. They'd spend their nights at our house when the snow would come in, and I actually idolized one of them. It was just he was my boyhood hero. Died of cirrhosis of the liver at age of 32, and I've stayed in touch with the Sioux culture over the years. And I really have come to the conclusion that we have to find a way to take down the reservation system. I just don't see how we can continue to have that separate and unequal way that we have settled these lands. I have friends in law enforcement in that part of the world, and you know these are sovereign entities, and they say that the national crime rates that we report through the FBI are inaccurate because they don't reflect the crime that goes on the reservation about what happens there. You know, the rampant alcoholism and drug use and the abuse in the families. And we've got to find a way out of that because it's a national shame in my judgment. And these were proud people. We came in the Indian Wars of the 19th century were a terrible period in our life. My life was changed in some way by reading Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. I was kind of vaguely aware of it until I read that book, and then I've gone back and looked at it in an entirely different way. I never liked Custer because I always thought that he was a guy who was out for personal glory and he would do anything that he needed to do, and he got his comeuppance when he got to Little Bighorn. But we are still working our way through all that. These were great native cultures, and they're in so many ways now, they're being compromised from within and from without. I have a friend who runs a community college on the Pine Ridge Reservation, and Tom Shortbull, he's the descendant of chiefs, and he's doing everything he can to train teachers and train nurses and get computer skills, but it's a daily, daily Sisyphean struggle pushing that rock back up the hill. So I would start to find a way to take down the reservation system and find assimilation as the answer.
Right. As someone who enjoys nature and has spent a great deal of time fishing, and I know this is something that is near and dear to your heart. Someone in the audience wants to know about your thoughts on global warming. What are the top things, three things they ask, but you know, the top issues in terms of global warming that you can identify that are that are a problem and also maybe things that the public should be aware of that can be done?
That I've done? Look, carbon-based fuels is the biggest single issue about how we begin to change that and our consumption of energy in this country. I thought there was a missed opportunity for the administration, for example, when they first came into office, to do something right away about energy and jobs and do a much smaller piece on healthcare, because I think people could have identified with that. And I have a passage in the book about we lost my mother recently, and it's fine. We're all at peace with it. She was this marvelous woman to live within 5 days of her 94th birthday. But she lived down in Southern California, in Orange County, in a retirement condominium that my wife and I had arranged from our parents. And I would visit her, and then on Sunday evening, I'd drive back up to Los Angeles, and I'd be on the 405, 8 lanes of traffic, at about 9 o'clock at night, dark. And when people would say to me later, gee, I just saw you in Afghanistan or we saw you in Iraq, weren't you terrified? I said, not as much as I was on the 405. I know that two or three lanes over, this guy who's all coked up from a day at the beach, for example, or somebody's doing tequila shots in the car, and we're all single passenger vehicles, and we're going 80 miles an hour to get up to Los Angeles, and we're just filling the sky with this stuff. It just is irrational in my judgment, and I've been a part of it. And we, at our ranch in Montana, we decided to go solar on one half of the ranch, and it was a big decision because it was a big initial investment to get off propane, go solar. It was a water-based system, and it would be heat and water. We thought it would take 5 years to amortize the cost. It took us 3 years. Water's never been hotter. All winter long, we've got extraordinary heat in the houses that are on the solar system in the middle of Montana. So there are ways of doing it. We haven't scaled it yet by any means. There's no question about that. But there's a lot of stuff going on, and we need all of us to take a part in it because it is real. And you see it in these weather systems. I was in British Columbia fishing a couple of years ago, and a guy said to me, oh, we got a big elk hunting season here for the first time. I said, what do you mean for the first time? He said, we never had elk before. But he said, all the warmer temperatures in the lower 48 are driving the elk farther north looking for cooler temperatures. This is a hunting guide. You know, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence. I'm going in January, late January, to Antarctica to look with some global warming scientists to look at the ice melt, the glacier melt, which is the best way you can see that. And I've done two documentaries on all this. I think it'll be changed by generations, young people coming up and growing up with the idea that we don't have to have as much of this stuff as we all do.
Tom, tell the story that you, because it kind of will button things up. I want to ask you one or two final questions, but tell the story you tell in the book about watching the elk try to cross the stream, because it really applies, as you applied in the book, to where we are today and how we can do more for one another.
It's the last story in the book. One of the unexpected dividends of being in Montana, my wife and I had spent a lot of time outdoors. We grew up in South Dakota, and then we became avid backpackers, first in California, although I'd done it as a child, and I introduced her to it in the Sierra, did it in Colorado, all over Montana and Wyoming. And then we got the ranch, and then we continued our very active outdoor lives. So when we got there, I don't think I knew quite what to expect in terms of the wildlife and how we would interact with it. But it's been the most meaningful experience in so many ways. And every year there's something that I learn from wildlife. And about 4 years ago, there was we have a river that snakes right through the ranch. And it's it gets at flood stage in the springtime because of snowpack and rain running off into it. And there's a promontory looking down onto an S-curve in the river. It's the most beautiful sight on our property, looking up into the Absaroka Wilderness. And I was up there checking the water one day, and there's a large conifer grove down below bordering the river. And out of that grove came 12 mother elk, 12 cows with their newborn calves. Calves couldn't have been more than, I don't think, more than 10 days old probably at that point. And they took one look at me, and I was about 200 yards away, and they quickly determined I probably was no threat to them. And they then led the calves into the river, which is at flood stage, and on the far bank were these hawthorn bushes, very thick bushes. And the big mothers were able to navigate the river and get through the bushes okay. The calves, this was a new experience. My guess is the first time they'd been in water like that. They're thrashing away, and they thrash onto the far bank, and they all make it except one. He gets swept downstream toward me. I'm up on a high bank thinking, what do I do here? And then he finds an eddy, a back current. He gets on the sandbar, tries again, fails a second time. Comes sweeping back down, gets in the eddy, goes back, tries a third time, fails a third time. Gets back up in the eddy, gets onto the sandbar, and I'm now taking in the whole tableau. We've got the mother elk over here on the far shore with the calves, all gathered together, watching him, waiting. He's over across the river on the sandbar, trembling at this point. One of the cow elk separates herself from the herd, walks down to the riverbank. God is my witness. Looked across the river and kind of nodded her majestic head as if to say, I'm coming to get you. Waded across, nuzzled him, and comforted him for a little while, and then led him slowly upstream to a safer place, got him across the river. They rejoined the herd, which waited for them. And then they went up over the hill to some pasture land that we have on the other side where they were going to spend the summer. I could barely breathe when this was all over. And as I walked back to the ranch house, I thought, that's a metaphor for all of us. We're at flood stage. We have to wait and help each other across in some fashion. So that was just, that's how I end the book about where we are.
And that's how I think we should end this conversation. It's a perfect button. Mr. Tom Brokaw, The Time of Our Lives is the book.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you all very much.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this afternoon's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. I'd once again like to thank Tom Brokaw, Dan Ashley, our audience here in Santa Clara, and for all those joining on the TV and radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.